So regardless of how you now feel about guilt or innocence, you would be willing to listen to the evidence and weigh it fairly before you decide the case.
The answer was so obvious that Mr. Pickard had no choice but to say, "Yes."
"Of course," Gaddis agreed. "And what about your wife? You mentioned her. She's a school teacher, right? She would be as open-minded as you, wouldn't she?"
"I think so, yes."
"And your employees, Mr. Pickard? Surely you hire honest, fair-minded people. They'd be able to ignore what they've read and heard and try this boy justly, wouldn't they?"
"I suppose."
"No further questions, Your Honor."
Mr. Pickard hustled off the witness stand and hurried from the courtroom. Lucian Wilbank stood and said rather loudly,
"Your Honor, the defense calls Mr. Willie Traynor."
A brick to the nose could not have hit Mr. Willie Traynor with more force. I gasped for air and heard Baggy say too loudly, "Oh, shit." Harry Rex was sitting in the jury box with some other lawyers, taking in the festivities. As I wobbled to my feet, I looked at him desperately for help. He was rising, too.
"Your Honor," he said, "I represent Mr. Traynor, and this young man has not been notified that he would be a witness."
"Go, Harry Rex, do something." The judge shrugged and said,
"So, he's here. What's the difference?"
There was not a trace of concern in his voice, and I knew I was nailed.
"It's an ambush, Judge,"
Harry Rex said.
"Sit down, Mr. Varner,"
His Honor replied, and I took a seat in the witness chair. The bailiff then swore me to tell the truth, and I watched as Wilbanks began pacing. The crowd behind him looked even larger. He began pleasantly enough with some preliminary inquiries about me and my purchase of the paper. I managed the correct answers, though I was extremely suspicious of every question. He was going somewhere. I had no idea where. The crowd seemed to enjoy this. My sudden takeover of the Times was still the source of interest and speculation, and suddenly there I was, in plain view of everyone, chatting about it under oath and on the record. Lucian suddenly produced copies of the Times and passed them to me, Gaddis, and Lupus.
He looked at me and said,
"Just for the record, Mr. Traynor, how many subscribers does the Times have now?"
"About 4,200, I answered with a little pride.
"And what percentage of your newspapers are sold in Ford County?"
"Virtually all. I don't have the exact numbers."
"Well, do you have any newsstands outside of Ford County?"
"No." Mr. Gaddis attempted a lame rescue. He stood and said,
"Your Honor, please, where is this going?"
Wilbank suddenly raised his voice and lifted a finger toward the ceiling.
"I will argue, Your Honor, that potential jurors in this county have been poisoned by the sensational coverage thrust upon us by the Ford County Times. Mercifully and justifiably, this newspaper has not been seen or read in other parts of the state. A change of venue is not only fair, but mandatory."
"I'll decide what's fair and mandatory, Mr. Wilbanks. Proceed,"
Judge Lupus said sharply. Mr. Wilbanks held up the paper and opened it to the second page.
"Your report has a rather detailed description of the interior of the home of Rhoda Castlelaw. When did you inspect the home?"
"I have not."
"When did you enter the home?"
"I have not."
"Yet you report that the bedroom of Miss Castlelaw's two small children was down a short hallway, approximately 15 feet from her bedroom door, and you estimate that their beds were about 30 feet from hers. How do you know this?"
"I have a source."
"A source? Has your source been in the house?"
"Yes."
"Is your source a police officer or a deputy?"
"He will remain confidential."
"How many confidential sources did you use for these stories?"
"Several." Wilbanks continued.
"You report that the children were in shock. How do you know this?"
"I spoke with Mr. Deese, the next door neighbor."
"Did he use the word shock?"
"He did."
"You report that the children were examined by a doctor here in Clanton on the night of the crime. How did you know this?"
"I had a source, and later I confirmed this with the doctor."
"And you report that the children are now undergoing some type of therapy back home in Missouri. Who told you that?"
"I talked to their aunt." He tossed the newspaper on the table and took a few steps in my direction. His bloodshot eyes narrowed and glared at me.
The truth is, Mr. Traynor, you tried to paint the unmistakable picture that these two little innocent children saw their mother get raped and murdered in her own bed. Isn't that right?
I took a deep breath and weighed my response. The courtroom was silent, waiting. I have reported the facts as accurately as possible, I said, staring straight at Baggy, who, though he was peeking around the lady in front of him, at least was nodding at me.
Is that so?
Will Banks grabbed the newspaper again and said,
I quote, will the children testify at trial? Did you write that, Mr. Traynor?
I couldn't deny it. I kicked myself for writing it. It was the last section of the reports that Baggy and I had haggled over. We'd both been a little squeamish, and with hindsight, we should have followed our instincts.
Denial was not possible.
Yes, I said.
Upon what accurate facts did you base that question?
It was a question I heard asked many times after the crime, I said. He flung the newspaper back on his table as if it were pure filth. He shook his head in mock bewilderment.
There are two children, right, Mr. Traynor?
Yes, a boy and a girl.
How old is the little boy?
5.
And how old is the little girl?
3.
And how old are you, Mr. Traynor?
23.
And in your 23 years, how many trials have you covered as a reporter?
None.
How many cases did you find where children age 5 or younger were allowed to testify in a criminal trial?
I glanced in the direction of Baggy, who, evidently, was now under the wooden bench.
None,
I said.
Perfect answer, Mr. Traynor. None. In the history of this state, no child under the age of 11 has ever testified in a criminal trial. Please write that down somewhere, and remember it the next time you attempt to inflame your readers with yellow journalism.
Enough, Mr. Wilbanks,
Judge Lupus said. A little too gently for my liking. I think he and the other lawyers, probably including Harry Rex, were enjoying this quick butchering of someone who'd meddled in legal affairs and gotten it all wrong. Even Mr. Gaddis seemed content to let me bleed. Lucian was wise enough to stop when the blood was flowing. He growled something like, I'm through with him. Mr. Gaddis had no questions. The bailiff motioned for me to step down, off the witness chair. And I tried desperately to walk upright back to the bench where Baggy was still hunkering down like a stray dog in a hailstorm. I scribbled notes through the rest of the hearing, but it was a failing effort to look busy and important. I could feel the stares. I was humiliated and wanted to lock myself in my office for a few days. Wilbanks ended things with an impassioned plea to move the case somewhere far away, maybe even the Gulf Coast, where perhaps a few folks had heard of the crime, but no one had been poisoned by the Times' coverage of it. He railed against me and my newspaper, and he went overboard. Mr. Gaddis, in his closing remarks, reminded the judge of the old saying,
strong and bitter words indicate a weak cause.
I wrote that down. Then I hustled out of the courtroom as if I had an important deadline. Baggy rushed into my office late the following morning with the hot news that Lucian Wilbanks had just withdrawn his motion to change venue. As usual, Baggy was full of analysis. His considered opinion was that the Pagets didn't want the trial moved to another county. They knew Danny was dead guilty and that he would almost certainly be convicted by a properly selected jury anywhere. Their sole chance was to get a jury they could either buy or intimidate. Since all guilty verdicts must be unanimous, they needed only a single vote in Danny's favor. Just one vote and the jury would hang itself. The judge would be required by law to declare a mistrial. It would certainly be retried, but with the same result. After 3 or 4 attempts, the state would give up. Baggy explained gravely that the hearing the day before had been staged by Lucian Wilbanks mainly to get me on the witness stand to peel off some skin.
Well, he damn sure did that, Baggy said.
Thanks, Baggy. Wilbanks was setting the stage for the trial, Baggy claimed, one that he knew all along would take place in Clanton, and he wanted the Times to tone down its coverage. Also, Baggy reasoned, Lucian Wilbanks never missed an opportunity to grandstand in front of a crowd. The third feast at the Ruffin House was a pot roast, and we ate on the porch as it rained steadily. As usual, I confess that I'd never had a pot roast, so Miss Callie described the recipe and the preparation in detail. Then she asked me if I wanted to say the blessing, and I declined. Praying was not something I'd done in a long time. She was far more gifted. She took my hands, and we closed our eyes. As she spoke to heaven, the rain tapped the tin roof above our heads. "Where's Esau?" I asked after my first three large bites. "At work. Sometimes he can get free for lunch. Often he cannot." She was preoccupied with something and finally said, "Can I ask you a question that's somewhat personal?"
"Sure, I guess."
"Are you a Christian child?"
"I'm sure I am," I answered. "My mother used to take me to an Episcopalian church on Easter."
"What kind of church do you attend?"
"Church of God in Christ," she answered quickly, and her entire face had a serene glow. "My pastor is the Reverend Thurston Small, a fine man of God. A powerful preacher, too. You should come hear him."
She launched into a long story about her church, which was within walking distance of her home. I loved it when she talked. It allowed me to eat nonstop, which was a priority. But I was still captivated by her precise diction, her cadence, and her vocabulary, which had to be college level. My story about Miss Callie and Esau and their remarkable children was almost complete. I was dragging out the research in hopes of spending a few more Thursday lunches on her porch. At first I'd felt guilty for having so much food prepared just for me. We ate only a fraction of it. But she assured me that nothing was thrown out. She and Esau and perhaps some friends would make sure the leftovers were properly put away.
"Well, nowadays I only cook 3 times a week,
she admitted with a hint of shame. Dessert was peach cobbler and vanilla ice cream. We agreed to wait an hour so we could pace ourselves. She brought 2 cups of strong black coffee, and we moved to the rocking chairs where we did our work. I pulled out my reporter's pad and pen and began making up questions. Miss Callie loved it when I wrote down things she said. Her first 7 children had Italian names. Alberto, Al, Leonardo, Leon, Massimo, Max, Roberto, Bobby, Gloria, Carlotta, and Mario. Only Sam, the youngest and the one rumored to be on the lam, had an American name. During my second visit, she had explained that she had been raised in an Italian home, right there in Ford County, but it was a very long story and she was saving it for later. The first 7 had all been valedictorians of their classes at Burley Street High, the colored school. Each had earned a Ph.D. and now taught in college. The biographical details filled pages, and Miss Callie, rightly so, could talk about her children for hours. And so she talked. I scribbled notes, rocked gently in my chair, listened to the rain, and finally fell asleep.
Baggy had some reservations about the Ruffin story. "It's really not news," he said as he read it.
I'm sure Hardy had alerted him that I was considering a large front-page story about a family of Negroes.
"This stuff is usually on page 5, he said.
Margaret was also skittish about the story, but as always, she deferred to the boss. In fact, the entire office was cool to the idea. I didn't care. I was doing what I thought was right. Plus, there was a big trial around the corner. And so, on Wednesday, May 20th, 1970, during a week in which there was absolutely nothing to print about the Castlelaw murder, the Times devoted more than half of its front page to the Ruffin family. It began with a large headline, "Ruffin Family Boasts 7 College Professors. Under it was a large photo of Callie and Esau sitting on their front steps, smiling proudly at the camera. Below them were the senior portraits of all 8 children, Al through Sam. In 1970, Dr. Alberto Ruffin was a professor of sociology at the University of Iowa. Dr. Leonardo Ruffin was a professor of biology at Purdue. Dr. Massimo Ruffin was a professor of economics at the University of Toledo. Dr. Roberto Ruffin was a professor of history at Marquette. Dr. Gloria Ruffin Sandiford taught Italian at Duke. Dr. Carlotta Ruffin was a professor of urban studies at UCLA. Dr. Mario Ruffin had just completed his Ph.D. in medieval literature and was a professor teaching at Grinnell College in Iowa. I mentioned Sam, but didn't dwell on him.
By phone, I had talked to all seven of the professors, and I quoted liberally from them in my story. The themes were common: love, sacrifice, discipline, hard work, encouragement, faith in God, faith in family, ambition, perseverance. No tolerance for laziness or failure. Each of the seven had a success story that could have filled an entire edition of the Times. Each had worked at least one full-time job while struggling through college and grad school. Most had worked two jobs. The older ones helped the younger ones. Mario told me he received 5 or 6 small checks each month from his siblings and parents. There was so much material on the Ruffins that I ran only part one that week. When I went to Lowtown for lunch the next day, Miss Callie met me with tears in her eyes. Esau met me, too, with a firm handshake and a stiff, awkward, manly hug. We devoured a lamb stew and compared notes on how the story was being received. Needless to say, it was the talk of Lowtown, with neighbors stopping by all Wednesday afternoon and Thursday morning with extra copies. I had mailed a half dozen or so to each of the professors. Over coffee and fried apple pies, their preacher, Reverend Thurston Small, parked in the street and made his way to the porch. I was introduced, and he seemed pleased to meet me. He quickly accepted a dessert and began a lengthy summary of how important the Ruffin story was to the black community of Clanton. Obituaries were fined, and in most southern towns, dead black folks were still ignored. Thanks to Mr. Caudle, progress was being made on one front. But to run such a grand and dignified profile of an outstanding black family on the front page was a giant step for racial tolerance in the town. I didn't see it that way. It was just a good human interest story about Miss Callie Ruffin and her extraordinary family. Other than being the unofficial and somewhat unreliable janitor for several businesses around the square, Piston had another job. He had an unlicensed courier service, and the bulk of his traffic was letters between law offices. He darted in late Friday morning with a hand-addressed letter from Lucian Wilbanks. I was almost afraid to open it. It read, "Dear Mr. Traynor, I enjoyed your profile on the Ruffin family, a most remarkable clan. I had heard of their achievements, but your story provided great insight. I admire your courage. I hope you continue in this more positive vein. Sincerely, Lucian Wilbanks." I detested the man, but who wouldn't have appreciated the note? Lucian enjoyed his reputation as a wild-eyed radical liberal who embraced unpopular causes. As such, his support at that moment gave limited comfort, and I knew it was only temporary. There were no other letters, no anonymous phone calls, no threats. School was out and the weather was hot. The ominous and much-dreaded winds of desegregation were gathering strength. The good folks of Ford County had more important matters to worry about. I skipped a week, then ran the second part of Miss Callie's story. On the bottom of the front page, I lined up current photos of the seven Ruffin professors. My story dealt with where they were now and what they were doing. Without exception, they professed great love for Clanton and Mississippi, though none planned to ever return permanently. They refused to judge a place that had kept them in inferior schools, kept them on one side of the tracks, kept them from voting and eating in most restaurants, and drinking water from the fountain on the courthouse lawn. They refused to dwell on anything negative. Instead, they thanked God for his goodness, for health, for family, for their parents, and for their opportunities. I marveled at their humility and kindness. Each of the seven promised to meet me during the Christmas vacation when we would sit on Miss Callie's porch and eat pecan pie and tell stories. Ernie Gaddis, the district attorney, filed a motion to enlarge the jury pool. According to Baggy, who was becoming more of an expert each day, in the typical criminal trial, the circuit court clerk summoned about 40 people for jury duty. About 35 would show up, and at least 5 of those would be too old or too sick to be qualified. Gaddis argued in his motion that the increased notoriety of the Castle Law murder would make it more difficult to find impartial jurors. He asked the court to summon at least 100 prospective jurors. What he didn't say in writing, but what everybody knew, was that the Pagets would have a harder time intimidating 100 than 40. Lucian Wilbanks objected strenuously and demanded a hearing.
Judge Lupus said one was not necessary and ordered a larger jury pool. He also took the unusual step of sealing the list of prospective jurors. Baggy and his drinking buddies and everyone else around the courthouse were shocked by this. It had never been done. The lawyers and litigants always got a complete list of the jury pool 2 weeks before trial. The order was generally viewed as a major setback to the Pagets. If they didn't know who was in the pool, then how could they bribe or frighten them? Gaddis then asked the court to have the jury summons mailed, not personally served by the sheriff's office. Lupus liked this idea, too. Evidently, he was well aware of the cozy relationship between the Pagets and our sheriff. Not surprisingly, Lucian Wilbanks screamed over this plan. In his rather frantic responses, he made the point that Judge Lupus was treating his client differently and unfairly. Reading his filings, I was amazed at how he could rant so clearly for so many pages. It was becoming obvious that Judge Lupus was determined to preside over a secure and unbiased trial. He had been the district attorney back in the 1950s before ascending to the bench, and he was known for his pro-prosecution leanings. He certainly appeared to have little concern for the Pagets and their legacy of corruption. Plus, on paper, and certainly in my paper, the case against Danny Paget appeared to be airtight. On Monday, June 15th, amid great secrecy, the circuit court clerk mailed 100 summonses for jury duty to registered voters all over Ford County. One arrived in the mailbox of Miss Callie Ruffin, and when I arrived for lunch on Thursday, she showed it to me. In 1970, Ford County was 26% black, 74% white, with no fractions for others or those who weren't certain. 6 years after the tumultuous summer of 1964 and its massive push to register blacks, and 5 years after the Voting Rights Act of 1965, few bothered to sign up in Ford County. In the statewide elections of 1967, almost 70% of the eligible whites in the county had voted, while only 12% of the blacks did so. Registration drives in Lowtown were met with general indifference. One reason was that the county was so white that no black could ever be elected to a local office, so why bother? Another reason was the historical abuse at the point of enrolling. For 100 years, whites had used a variety of tricks to deny blacks proper registration. Poll taxes, literacy exams, the list was long and miserable. Yet another reason was the hesitancy by most blacks to be registered in any manner by white authorities. Registration could mean more taxes, more supervision, more surveillance, more intrusions. Registration could mean serving on juries. According to Harry Rex, who was a slightly more reliable courthouse source than Baggy, there had never been a black juror in Ford County. Since potential jurors were selected from the voter registration rolls and nowhere else, few showed up in a jury pool. Those who survived the early rounds of questioning were routinely excused before the final 12 were impaneled. In criminal cases, the prosecution routinely challenged blacks under the belief that they would be too sympathetic to the accused. In civil cases, the defense challenged them because they were feared as too liberal with the money of others. However, these theories had never been tested in Ford County. Callie and Esau Ruffin registered to vote in 1951. Together, they marched into the office of the circuit court clerk and asked to be added to the voter rolls. The deputy clerk, as she was trained to do, handed them a laminated card with the words Declaration of Independence across the top. The text was written in German. The clerk, assuming that Mr. and Mrs. Ruffin were as illiterate as most blacks in Ford County, said, "Can you read this?" "This is not English," Callie said. "It's German." "Can you read it?" the clerk asked, realizing that she might have her hands full with this couple. "I can read as much of it as you can," Callie said politely. The clerk withdrew the card and handed over another. "Can you read this?" she asked. "I can," Callie said. "It's the Bill of Rights." "What does number 8 say?" Callie read it slowly, then said, "The 8th Amendment prohibits excessive fines and cruel punishments." At about this time, depending on whose version was being described, Esau leaned in and said, "We are property owners." He placed the deed to their home on the counter and the deputy clerk examined it. Property ownership was not a prerequisite to voting, but it was a huge asset if you were black. Not knowing what else to do, she said, "Fair enough. The poll tax will be $2 each." Esau handed over the money, and with that they joined the voter rolls with 31 other blacks, none of whom were women. At first I couldn't tell if she was anxious or excited. I'm not sure she knew either. The first black female voter might now become the first black juror. She had never backed away from a challenge, but she had grave moral concerns about judging another person. "Judge not that ye be not judged," she said more than once, quoting Jesus. But if everyone followed that verse of scripture, our entire judicial system would fail, wouldn't it? I asked. "I don't know," she said, gazing away. I had never seen Miss Callie so preoccupied. We were eating fried chicken with mashed potatoes and gravy. Esau had not made it home for lunch. "How can I judge a man I know to be guilty?" she asked. "First you listen to the evidence," I said. "You have an open mind. It won't be difficult." "What about the death penalty? Will they want to put that boy in the gas chamber?" "Yes, ma'am. It's a capital murder case." "Who decides whether he is put to death?"
"The jury."
"Oh, my."
She was unable to eat after that. She said her blood pressure had been up since she received the jury summons. She had already been to the doctor. I helped her to the sofa in the den and took her a glass of ice water. She insisted that I finish my lunch, which I happily did in silence. Later she rallied a bit and we sat on the porch in the rockers, talking about anything but Danny Paget and his trial. I finally hit pay dirt when I asked her about the Italian influence in her life. She needed to tell me a story. I had absolutely nothing else to do. In the 1890s, the price of cotton rose dramatically as demand increased around the world. The large plantation owners in the Mississippi Delta desperately wanted to increase their crops, but they faced a severe labor shortage. Many of the blacks who were physically able had fled the land their ancestors toiled as slaves for better jobs and certainly better lives up north. The landowners hit upon a scheme to import hard-working European immigrants to raise cotton. Through contacts with Italian labor agents in New York and New Orleans, connections were made, promises swapped, lies told, contracts forged, and in 1895 the first boatload of families arrived in the Delta. They were treated worse than most black farm workers. Over time, some efforts were made to divide profits and transfer ownership of land, but the cotton markets fluctuated so wildly that the arrangements could never be stabilized. After 20 years of abuse, the Italians finally scattered and the experiment became history. Those who remained in the Delta were considered second-class citizens for decades. They were excluded from schools, and because they were Catholic, they were not welcome in churches. The country clubs were off-limits. They were dagos and shoved to the bottom of the social ladder. But because they worked hard and saved their money, they slowly accumulated land. The Rossetti family landed near Leland, Mississippi in 1902. They were from a village near Bologna and had the misfortune of listening to the wrong labor agent in that city. Mr. and Mrs. Rossetti brought with them 4 daughters, the oldest of which was Nicola, age 12. Though they often went hungry the first year, they managed to avoid outright starvation. Penniless when they arrived, after 3 years of peonage, the family had racked up $6,000 in debts to the plantation with no possible way of paying them off. They fled the Delta in the middle of the night and rode a boxcar to Memphis, where a distant relative took them in. At the age of 15, Nicola was stunningly beautiful. Long dark hair, brown eyes, a classic Italian beauty. She looked older than her years and managed to get a job in a clothing store by telling the owner she was 18. In those days, the wealthy farming families in northern Mississippi did their shopping and socializing in Memphis, usually within walking distance of the Peabody Hotel. It was there that Mr. Zachary DeJarnett of Clanton had the blind luck of bumping into Nicola Rossetti. 2 weeks later, they were married. He was 31, a widower with no children and in the midst of a serious search for a wife. He was also the largest landowner in Ford County, where the soil was not as rich as in the Delta, but still quite profitable if you owned enough of it.
Mr. DeJarnett had inherited over 4,000 acres from his family. His grandfather had once owned the grandfather of Kalia Harris Ruffin. The marriage was a package deal. Nicola was wise beyond her years, and she was also desperate to protect her family. And so the first Italians in Ford County arrived not in a broken ox cart, but rather by first-class passage on the Illinois Central Rail Line. A welcoming party unloaded their brand-new luggage and helped them into two 1904 Ford Model Ts. A few minutes later, they finally made it to the main house at the edge of town. When the Rossettis turned into the long front drive and glimpsed the stately antebellum mansion built by the first Mr. DeJarnett, they all broke into tears. It was decided that they would live there until an overseer's house could be renovated and made suitable. Nicola assumed her duties as the lady of the manor and tried her best to get pregnant. Her younger sisters were provided with private tutors, and within weeks were speaking good English. Mr. Rossetti spent each day with his son-in-law, who was only 3 years his junior, and learned how to run the plantation. And Mrs. Rossetti went to the kitchen, where she met Callie's mother, India.
"My grandmother cooked for the DeJarnetts. So did my mother," Miss Callie told me. "When I was born in 1911, Nicola practically took me away from my mother. She insisted I have an Italian name. She kept me in the big house with her. My mother didn't mind. She had plenty of other children. Plus, she was in the house all day long. Nicola dressed me in clothes she bought in Memphis. When I was a toddler, she taught me to speak Italian while I was learning English. She taught me to read when I was 3 years old."
The story was running in many directions. I wanted to record some of it, but I had not brought a notepad. The image of a young black girl living in an antebellum home speaking Italian had to be unique.
"Did you think about going to college later on?" I asked.
But Miss Callie was suddenly exhausted and story time was over.
"Ah, oh, Mr. Traynor, it was very sad. Mr. DeJarnett lost everything back in the 1920s. He'd invested heavily in railroads and ships and stocks and such stuff, and went broke almost overnight. He shot himself. But that's another story."
"What happened to Nicola?"
"She was childless, you know, even though they wanted children badly. She managed to hold on to the big house until the Second War. Then she moved back to Memphis with Mr. and Mrs. Rossetti. We swapped letters every week for years. I still have them. She died 4 years ago, at the age of 76. I cried for a month. I still cry when I think of her. How I loved that woman."
Her words trailed off, and I knew from experience that she was ready for a nap. On Monday, June 22nd, all but 8 of the 100 jurors arrived for the trial of Danny Paget. As we soon found out, 4 were dead and 4 had simply vanished. For the most part, the rest looked very anxious. Few things draw a crowd in a small town like a good murder trial, and the courtroom was full long before 9 a.m. The prospective jurors filled one side, spectators the other. The old balcony practically sagged above us. The walls were lined with people. As a show of strength, Chef Coley had every available uniformed body milling around, looking important, doing nothing productive. What a perfect time to pull a bank heist, I thought. Sitting in chairs pulled close to the defense table, the Pagets were there in full force. I caught a few stares from them, but they were much more worried about the jurors than me. They watched them closely as they filed into the courtroom and took their instructions from the clerk. The Pagets and their lawyers looked at lists they had found somewhere. They compared notes. Danny was nicely but casually dressed in a white long-sleeve shirt and a pair of starched khakis. As instructed by Wilbanks, he was smiling a lot, as if he were really a nice kid whose innocence was about to be revealed. Across the aisle, Ernie Gaddis and his smaller crew were likewise observing the prospective jurors. Gaddis had two assistants, one a paralegal, and one a part-time prosecutor named Hank Hooten. The paralegal carried the files and briefcases. Hooten seemed to do little but just be there so Ernie would have someone to confer with. Baggy leaned over as if it was time to whisper.
"That guy there, brown suit," he said, nodding at Hooten. "He was screwing Rhoda Castlelaw."
I was shocked, and my face showed it. I jerked to the right and looked at Baggy.
He nodded smugly and said what he always said when he had the scoop on something really nasty.
"That's what I'm telling you," he whispered.
This meant that he had no doubts. Baggy was often wrong, but never in doubt. Hooten appeared to be about 40, with prematurely gray hair, nicely dressed, somewhat handsome.
"Where's he from?"
I whispered. The courtroom was noisy as we waited for Judge Lupus.
"Here? He does some real estate law. Low-pressure stuff. A real jerk. Been divorced a couple of times. Always on the prowl."
"Does Gaddis know his assistant was seeing the victim?"
"Hell no. Ernie would pull him from the case."
"You think Wilbanks knows?"
"Nobody knows,"
Baggy said with even greater smugness. It was as if he had personally caught them in bed, then kept it to himself until that very moment in the courtroom. I wasn't sure I believed him. Miss Callie arrived a few minutes before 9. Esau escorted her into the courtroom, then had to leave when he couldn't find a seat. She checked in with the clerk and was placed in the third row. She was given a questionnaire to fill out. She looked around for me, but there were too many people between us. I counted 4 other blacks in the pool. A bailiff bellowed for us to rise, and it sounded like a stampede. Judge Lupus told us to sit, and the floor shook. He went straight to work and appeared to be in good spirits. He had a courtroom full of voters, and he was up for re-election in 2 years, though he had never had an opponent. 6 jurors were excused because they were over the age of 65. 5 were excused for medical reasons. The morning began to drag. I couldn't take my eyes off Hank Hooten. He certainly had the look of a ladies' man. When the preliminary questions were over, the panel was down to 79 duly qualified jurors. Miss Callie was now in the second row. Not a good sign if she wanted to avoid jury service. Judge Lupus yielded the floor to Ernie Gaddis, who introduced himself to the panel again and explained in great length that he was there on behalf of the state of Mississippi, the taxpayers, the citizens who had elected him to prosecute those who commit crimes. He was the people's lawyer. After a few minutes, Ernie asked a question that cut through the air like a rifle shot.
"Do all of you folks understand that jury tampering is a crime?"
They seemed to understand.
"And that I, as the prosecutor, will pursue, indict, bring to trial, and do my utmost to convict any person involved with jury tampering. Do you understand this?"
It was very effective. Ernie sat down and Lucian Wilbanks launched into a lengthy and quite dull lecture about the presumption of innocence and how it is the foundation of American jurisprudence. We were approaching noon and everybody was anxious for a break. Wilbanks seemed to miss this and he kept rattling on. When he sat down at 12:15, Judge Lupus announced that he was starving. We would recess until 2 o'clock. Baggy and I had a sandwich upstairs in the bar room with several of his cronies, 3 aging, washed-up lawyers who hadn't missed a trial in years. Baggy really wanted a glass of whiskey, but for some odd reason felt the call of duty. His pals did not. The clerk had given us a list of jurors as they were currently seated. Miss Callie was number 22, the first black and the 3rd female. It was the general feeling that the defense would not challenge her because she was black, and blacks, according to the prevailing theory, were sympathetic to those accused of crimes. I wasn't sure how a black person could be sympathetic to a white thug like Danny Paget, but the lawyers were unshakable in their belief that Lucian Wilbanks would gladly take her. Under the same theory, the prosecution would exercise one of its arbitrary, peremptory challenges and strike her from the panel. "Not so," said Chick Elliott, the oldest and drunkest of the gang.
"I'd take her if I were prosecuting," he argued, then knocked back a potent shot of bourbon.
"Why?"
Baggy asked. "Because we know her so well now, thanks to the times. She came across as a sensible, God-fearing, Bible-quoting patriot who raised all those kids with a heavy hand and a swift kick in the ass if they screwed up."
They argued for an hour. It was my first session with them, and I suddenly understood how Baggy collected so many differing opinions about so many issues. Though I tried not to show it, I was deeply concerned that my long and generous stories about Miss Callie would somehow come back to haunt her. After lunch, Judge Lupus moved into the most serious phase of questioning, the death penalty. He explained the nature of a capital defense and the procedures that would be followed. Then he yielded again to Ernie Gaddis.
Juror number 11 was a member of some obscure church, and he made it very clear that he could never vote to send a person to the gas chamber. Juror number 34 was a veteran of two wars, and he felt rather strongly that the death penalty wasn't used often enough. This, of course, delighted Ernie, who singled out individual jurors and politely asked them questions about judging others and imposing the death sentence. He eventually made it to Miss Callie.
"Now, Mrs. Ruffin, I've read about you, and you seem to be a very religious woman. Is this correct?"
"I do love the Lord, yes, sir,"
she answered, as clear as always.
"Are you hesitant to sit in judgment of another human?"
"I am, yes, sir."
"Do you want to be excused?"
"No, sir. It's my duty as a citizen to be here, same as all these other folks."
"And if you're on the jury and the jury finds Mr. Paget guilty of these crimes, can you vote to put him to death?"
"I certainly wouldn't want to."
"My question was, can you?"
"I can follow the law, same as these other folks. If the law says that we should consider the death penalty, then I can follow the law."
4 hours later, Kalia H. Ruffin became the last juror chosen, the first black to serve on a trial jury in Ford County. The drunks up in the barroom had been right. The defense wanted her because she was black. The state wanted her because they knew her so well. Plus, Ernie Gaddis had to save his jury strikes for less appealing characters. Late that night, I sat alone in my office working on a story about the opening day in jury selection. I heard a familiar noise downstairs. Harry Rex had a way of shoving open the front door and stomping on the wooden floor so that everybody at the Times, regardless of the time of day, knew he had arrived.
"Willie boy,"
he yelled from below.
"Up here,"
I yelled back. He rumbled up the stairs and fell into his favorite chair.
"What do you think of the jury?"
he said. He appeared to be completely sober. "I only know one of them," I said. "How many do you know?"
"7.
"You think they picked Miss Callie because of my stories?"
"Yep,"
he said, brutally honest as always.
"Everybody's been talking about her. Both sides felt like they knew her. It's 1970 and we've never had a black juror. She looked as good as any. Does that worry you?"
"I guess it does."
"Why? What's wrong with serving on a jury? It's about time we had blacks doing it. She and her husband have always been anxious to break down barriers. Ain't like it's dangerous. Well, normally it ain't dangerous."
I hadn't talked to Miss Callie, and I would not be able to do so until after the trial. Judge Lupus had ordered the jurors sequestered for the week. By then they were hiding in a motel in another town. "Any suspicious characters on the jury?" I asked.
"Maybe. Everybody's worried about that cripple boy out near Dumas. Farguson. Hurt his back in a sawmill owned by his uncle. My uncle sold timber to the Pagets many years ago. The boy has some attitude. Gaddis wanted to bump him, but he ran out of challenges."
The crippled boy walked with a cane and was at least 25 years old. Harry Rex referred to anyone younger than himself, and especially me, as boy.
"But with the Pagets, you never know," he continued. "Hell, they could own half the jury by now."
"You don't really believe that, do you?"
"No, but a hung jury wouldn't surprise me either. It might take 2 or 3 shots at this boy before Ernie gets him."
Tuesday morning, with all of us looking on, including Esau, who was in the back row, Judge Lupus nodded at the bailiff, and the jurors were let in. The judge welcomed them, thanked them, asked about their accommodations, apologized for the inconvenience, and promised that things would move forward. Ernie Gaddis assumed a position behind the podium and began his opening statement to the jury. He had a yellow legal pad, but he didn't look at it. With great efficiency, he rattled off the necessary elements the state would prove against Danny Paget. His confident tone and concise remarks conveyed the clear message that he had the facts, the case, and he would get his verdict. Oddly, Lucian Wilbanks deferred his opening remarks until the defense put on its case, an option rarely exercised.
"He's up to something,"
Baggy mumbled, as if he and Lucian were thinking together.
"No surprise there."
The first witness for the state was Sheriff Coley himself. Part of his job was testifying in criminal cases. but it was doubtful he'd ever dreamed of doing so against a Paget. In a few months, he would be up for re-election. It was important for him to look good before the voters. With Ernie's meticulous planning and prodding, they walked through the crime. There were large diagrams of the Castle Law home, the Deese home, the roads around Beech Hill, the exact spot where Danny Paget was arrested. There were photographs of the area. Then there were photographs of Rhoda's corpse. A series of 8x10s that were handed to the jurors and passed around. Their reactions were amazing. Every face was shocked. Some winced. A few mouths flew open. Miss Callie closed her eyes and appeared to pray. Another lady on the jury, Mrs. Barbara Baldwin, gasped at first sight and turned away. Then she looked at Danny Paget as if she could shoot him at point-blank range. "Oh, my God," one of the men mumbled. Another covered his mouth as if he might throw up. The jurors sat in padded swivel chairs that rocked slightly. As the gruesome photos were passed around, not a single chair was still. The pictures were inflammatory, highly prejudicial, yet always admissible, and as they caused a commotion in the jury box, I thought Danny Paget was as good as dead. Judge Lupus allowed only 6 as exhibits. 1 would have sufficed. It was just after 1 p.m., and everyone needed a break. I doubted that the jurors had much of an appetite. The state's second witness was one of Rhoda's sisters from Missouri. Her name was Ginger McClure, and I had talked to her several times after the murder. When she realized I'd gone to school at Syracuse and was not a native of Ford County, she had thawed somewhat. She had reluctantly sent me a photo for the obituary. Later she'd called and asked if I could send her copies of the Times when it mentioned Rhoda's case. She expressed frustration in getting details from the district attorney's office. Ginger was a slim redhead, very attractive and well-dressed, and when she settled into the witness chair, she had everyone's attention. According to Baggy, someone from the victim's family always testified. Death became real when the loved ones took the stand and looked at the jurors. Ernie wanted Ginger to be viewed by the jury and arouse their sympathy. He also wanted to remind the jury that the mother of 2 small children had been taken from them in a premeditated murder. Her testimony was brief. Wisely, Lucian Wilbanks had no questions on cross-examination. When she was excused, she walked to a reserved chair behind the bar, near the seat of Ernie Gaddis, and assumed the position as representative of the family. Her every move was watched until the next witness was called. Then it was back to the gore. A forensic pathologist from the state crime lab was called to discuss the autopsy. Though he had plenty of photos, none were used. None were needed. In layman's terms, her cause of death was obvious. A loss of blood. There was a 4-inch gash beginning just below her left ear and running almost straight down. It was almost 2 inches deep, and in his opinion, and he'd seen many knife wounds, it was caused by a rapid and powerful thrust from a blade that was approximately 6 inches long and 1 inch wide. The person using the knife was more than likely right-handed. The gash cut completely through the left jugular vein, and at that point the victim had only a few minutes to live. A second gash was 6.5 inches long, 1 inch deep, and ran from the tip of the chin and to the right ear, which had almost sliced in 2. This wound by itself probably would not have resulted in death. Lucian Wilbanks began his cross pleasantly enough. The two had hooked up before in trials. He made the pathologist admit that some of his opinions might possibly be wrong, such as the size of the murder weapon and whether the assailant was right-handed. "I stated that these were probabilities," the doctor said patiently. I got the impression that he'd been grilled so many times nothing rattled him. Wilbanks poked and probed a bit, but he was careful not to revisit the damning evidence. The jury had heard enough of the cuts and gashes. It would be foolish to cover this ground again. A second pathologist followed. Concurrent with the autopsy, he had made a thorough examination of the body and found several clues as to the identity of the killer. In the vaginal area, he found semen that matched perfectly with Danny Paget's blood. Under the nail of Rhoda's right index finger, he had found a tiny piece of human skin. It, too, matched the defendant's blood type. After 4 hours of graphic testimony, everybody in the courtroom was exhausted. Judge Lupus sent the jury away with stern warnings about avoiding outside contact. It seemed overkill in light of the fact that they were being hidden in another town and guarded by police. Baggy and I raced back to the office and typed frantically until almost 10. It was Tuesday, and Hardy liked to have the presses running no later than 11 p.m. On those rare weeks when there were no mechanical problems, he could run 5,000 copies in less than 3 hours. Hardy set the type as quickly as possible. There was no time for editing and proofreading. Baggy was hitting the sauce as we finished up and couldn't wait to leave. I was about to head for my apartment when Ginger McClure strolled in the front door and said hello as if we were old friends. She was wearing tight jeans and a red blouse. She asked if I had anything to drink. Not at the office, but that wouldn't stop us. We left the square in my Spitfire and drove to Quincy's, where I bought a 6-pack of Schlitz. She wanted to see Rhoda's house one last time, from the road, not too close. As we headed that way, I cautiously inquired about the 2 children. The report was mixed. Both were living with another sister. Ginger was quick to tell me she was recently divorced, and both were undergoing intense counseling. The little boy appeared to be almost normal, though he sometimes drifted off into prolonged periods of silence. The little girl was much worse. She had constant nightmares about her mother and had lost the ability to control her bladder. The doctors were experimenting with various drugs. Neither child would tell the family or the doctors how much they saw that night. "They saw their mother get raped and stabbed," she said, killing off the first beer. Mine was still half full. The Deese home looked as if Mr. and Mrs. Deese had been asleep for days. We turned into the gravel driveway of what was once the happy little Castle Law home. It was empty, dark, and had an abandoned look to it. There was a for sale sign in the yard. The house was the only significant asset in Rhoda's small estate. The proceeds would all go to the children. When we drove away, I saw Mr. Deese crouching in the shadows of his garage, holding a shotgun. He was scheduled to be the last witness called by the state. Ginger was staying at a local motel, but she did not want to go there. It was after midnight. Our options were thin, so we drove to the Hocut place, where I led her up the stairs, over the cats, and into my apartment. "Don't get any ideas," she said as she kicked off her shoes and sat on the sofa. "I'm not in the mood." "Neither am I," I lied. Her tone was almost flippant, as though her mood might change real soon, and when it did, then we could have a go at it. I was perfectly happy to wait. I found colder beer in the kitchen, and we settled into our places as if we might talk until sunrise. "Tell me about your family," she said. It was not my best subject, but for this lady I could talk. "I'm an only child. My mother died when I was 13. My father lives in Memphis in an old family house that he never leaves because both he and the house have a few loose boards. He has an office in the attic, and he stays there all day and night trading stocks and bonds. I don't know how well he trades, but I have a hunch he loses more than he gains. We speak by phone once a month." "Are you wealthy?" "No, my grandmother is wealthy. My mother's mother, Bibi. She loaned me the money to buy the paper." She thought about this as she sipped her beer. "There were 3 of us girls. 2 now, she said. "We were pretty wild growing up. My father went out for milk and eggs one night and never came home. My mother has tried twice more since then. Can't seem to get it right. I'm divorced. My older sister is divorced. Rhoda's dead." She reached across with the bottle and tapped mine. "Here's to a couple of screwed up families." We drank to that. Divorced, childless, wild, and very cute. I could spend time with Ginger. She wanted to know about Ford County and its characters. Lucian Wheelbanks, the Pagets, Sheriff Coley, and so on. I talked and talked and kept waiting for her mood to change. It did not. Sometime after 2 a.m., she stretched out on the sofa, and I went to bed alone. 3 of the Hocuts, Max, Wilma, and Gilma, were loitering around the garage under my apartment when Ginger and I made our exit a few hours later. I guess they wanted to meet her. They looked at her scornfully as I made cheerful introductions. I half expected Max to say something ridiculous like, "We did not contemplate illicit sex when we leased this place to you." But nothing offensive was said, and we quickly drove to the office. She jumped in her car and disappeared. The latest edition was stacked floor to ceiling in the front room. I grabbed a copy for a quick perusal. The headline was fairly restrained. Danny Padgett trial begins. Jury sequestered. There were no photos of the defendant. We had used enough of those already, and I wanted to save a big one for the following week when hopefully we could nail the little thug leaving the courthouse after receiving his death sentence. On Wednesday morning, the jurors were led in, and Ernie Gaddis called his next witness. His name was Chubb Bruner, the longtime investigator for the Sheriff's Department. According to both Baggy and Harry Rex, Bruner was famous for his incompetence. To wake up the jury and captivate the rest of us, Gaddis produced the bloody white shirt Danny Padgett was wearing the night he was arrested. It had been removed from the body of Danny Padgett by a deputy named Grice, in the presence of Bruner and Sheriff Coley. Tests had revealed two types of blood, O positive and B positive. Further tests by the state crime lab matched the B positive with the blood of Rhoda Castlelaw. I watched Ginger as she looked at the shirt. After a few minutes, she looked away and began writing something. Not surprisingly, she looked even better her second day in the courtroom. I was very concerned about her moods. The shirt was ripped across the front. Danny had cut himself when he crawled out of his wrecked truck and had received 12 stitches. Bruner did a passable job of explaining this to the jury. After 15 minutes, Ernie sat down and Lucian Wilbanks approached the witness. Lucian wisely ignored the fact that Rhoda's blood was found on Danny's shirt and chose instead to hammer Bruner on the subject of footprints.
"Did you dust the crime scene for fingerprints?" he asked.
"Yes."
"Routine, isn't it?"
"Yes, always."
"And, of course, you fingerprinted Mr. Padgett when he was arrested, right?"
"Yes."
"Good. How many of Mr. Padgett's fingerprints did you find at the crime scene?"
"None."
"Not a single one, did you?"
"None."
With that, Lucian picked a good moment to sit down. It was difficult to believe that the murderer could enter the house, hide there for a while, rape and murder his victim, then escape without leaving behind fingerprints. But Chubb Bruner did not inspire a lot of confidence. With him in charge of the investigation, there seemed an excellent chance that dozens of fingerprints could have been missed. Judge Lupus called for the morning recess, and as the jurors stood to leave, I made eye contact with Miss Callie. Her face exploded into one huge grin. She nodded as if to say, "Don't worry about me." We stretched our legs and whispered about what we had just heard. I was delighted to see so many people in the courtroom reading the Times. I walked to the bar and leaned down to speak to Ginger.
"You doing okay?" I asked.
"I just want to go home," she said softly.
"How about lunch?"
"You got it."
The state's last witness was Mr. Aaron Deese. He walked to the stand shortly before 11 a.m., and we braced for his recollection of that night. Ernie Gaddis led him through a series of questions designed to personalize Rhoda and her two children. They had lived next door for 7 years, perfect neighbors, wonderful people. He missed them greatly, couldn't believe they were gone. At one point, Mr. Deese wiped a tear from his eye. There was nothing in his testimony that could be challenged or impeached, so Lucian Wilbanks declined a cross-examination. The state rested, and we broke for lunch. I drove Ginger to Caraway, to the only Mexican place I knew, and we ate enchiladas under an oak tree and talked about everything but the trial. She was subdued and wanted to leave Ford County forever. I really wanted her to stay. Lucian Wilbanks began his defense with a little pep talk about what a nice young man Danny Padgett really was. He had finished high school with good grades. He worked long hours in the family's timber business. He dreamed of one day running his own company. He had no police record whatsoever. His only brush with the law had been one, just one, speeding ticket when he was 16 years old. Lucian's persuasive skills were reasonably well honed, but he was collapsing under the weight of the effort. It was impossible to make a Padgett appear warm and cuddly. There was quite a bit of squirming in the courtroom, some smirks here and there. But we weren't the ones deciding the case. Lucian was talking to the jurors, looking them in the eyes,
and no one knew if he and his client had already locked up a vote or two. However, Danny was not a saint. Like most handsome young men, he had discovered he enjoyed the company of ladies. He had met the wrong one, though, a woman who happened to be married to someone else. Danny was with her the night Rhoda Castlelaw was murdered.
"Listen to me," he bellowed at the jurors. "My client did not kill Miss Castlelaw. At the time of this horrible murder, he was with another woman, in her home not far from the Castlelaw place. He has an airtight alibi."
This announcement sucked the air out of the courtroom, and for a long minute we waited for the next surprise. Lucian played the drama perfectly.
"This woman, his lover, will be our first witness," he said.
They brought her in moments after Lucian finished his opening remarks. Her name was Lydia Vince. I whispered to Baggy, and he said he'd never heard of her. Didn't know any Vinces from out in Beach Hill. There were a lot of whispers in the courtroom as folks tried to place her. Engaging from the frowns and puzzled looks and head shakes, it appeared as though the woman was a complete unknown. Lucian's preliminary questions revealed that she was living in a rented house on Hurt Road back in March, but was now living in Tupelo, that she and her husband were going through a divorce, that she had one child, that she grew up in Tyler County, and that she was currently unemployed. She was about 30 years old, somewhat attractive in a cheap way, short skirt, tight blouse over a big chest, bottle blonde hair, and she was utterly terrified of the proceedings. She and Danny had been having an adulterous affair for about a year. I glanced at Miss Callie and was not surprised to see this was not sitting well. On the night Rhoda was murdered, Danny was at her house. Malcolm Vince, her husband, was supposedly in Memphis doing something with the boys. She really didn't know what. He was gone a lot in those days. She and Danny had sex twice, and sometime around midnight he was preparing to leave when her husband's truck turned into the driveway. Danny sneaked out the rear door and disappeared. The shock of a married woman admitting in open court that she had committed adultery was designed to convince the jury that she had to be telling the truth. No one, respectable or otherwise, would admit this. It would damage her reputation, if she cared about such things. It would certainly impact her divorce, perhaps jeopardize custody of her child. It might even allow her husband to sue Danny Paget for alienation of affection, though it was doubtful the jurors were thinking that far ahead. Her answers to Lucian's questions were brief and very well rehearsed. She refused to look at the jurors or at her alleged former lover. Instead, she kept her eyes down and appeared to be looking at Lucian's shoes. Both the lawyer and the witness were careful not to venture outside the script.
"She's lying," Baggy whispered loudly, and I agreed.
When the direct examination was over, Ernie Gaddis stood and walked deliberately to the podium, staring with great suspicion at this self-confessed adulteress. He kept his reading glasses on the tip of his nose and looked above them with wrinkled brow and narrow eyes.
"Miss Vince, this house on Hurt Road, who owned it?"
"Jack Hagel."
"How long did you live there?"
"About a year."
"Did you sign a lease?"
She hesitated for a split second too long, then said,
"Maybe my husband did. I really don't remember."
"When did you file for divorce?"
Her eyes lifted quickly and she glanced at Lucian, who was listening hard but refusing to watch her.
"We haven't actually filed papers yet,"